Hey everybody, it's Paul Scheer from How Did This Get Made? I wanted to let you know that we have a brand new website. It's hdtgminfo.com. You can find out everything that you need to know about How Did This Get Made on that site, where we're doing live shows, where to buy tickets, what the movies are. Everything and anything is there. And I want to let you know that we have shows coming up in New York and Denver and in some other places that we can't quite announce yet. So bookmark hdtgminfo.com.
That's not a sequel. This is a sequel. We saw Crocodile Dundee in Los Angeles, so you know what that means.
Now it's time for How Did This Get Made? We're gonna have a good time, celebrate some failure, not just be a hater, cause you know you wonder, how did this get made? Let's wallow in the mediocrity of subpar art. Perhaps we'll find the answer to the question, how did this get made?
Hello, people of Earth, and welcome to How Did This Get Made? I am Paul Scheer, joined, as always, by my two co-hosts, Jason Mendzoukas. How are you, Jason?
I'm good, Paul. How are you?
Very good. And June Diane Raphael. How are you, June?
I'm great. How are you, Paul?
Very good. Very good. Formal. We have two special guests here today. First off, this guy is a very funny, talented comedian who has a brand new documentary about him out called The Bitter Buddha. Please welcome Eddie Pepitone. Eddie, welcome to the
hey,
show.
Hey!
That's a very good intro.
That's Eddie Pepitone's classic salutation.
Let's go. I am so ready for this podcast.
So we actually have a very interesting episode. Due to some technical difficulties today, this podcast is going to have a lot of moving parts. It's not going to be like the regular podcast, so I'm going to ask you guys to bear with us. We have a very special guest coming up. We have Matthew Berry, the writer of Crocodile Dundee, later in the episode to talk to us a little bit about the movie. He's also here to plug his book, Fantasy Life, and you can go check that out at fantasylifethebook.com. But before we bring Matthew Berry in, let's talk about this movie. Crocodile Dundee 3, This movie, to me, it's so crazy what is going on here. Because the beginning is, the beginning is so kind of slow and lackadaisical.
The show now has dulcet tones piped throughout. In case you're wondering.
I thought I was having a stroke.
We're going to put like really mellow tones in the show just to like, because our audiences are getting, we're getting reports very agitated while listening to the show.
Sorry, Dave.
I do feel like I got a sense in that beginning part of the movie. They're like, we don't have enough to fill the 88 minutes.
Yeah.
Like, let's have another shot of these gazelles, another shot of these like elephants going around. Like, because that whole sequence in Australia, I didn't even understand.
Oh, yeah.
What you're saying.
You think the movie would then take place in Australia, and it doesn't.
No. I knew it was coming to LA from the title.
Well, from the title.
Oh, really?
So that's how you figured that out.
I didn't get that. I didn't understand the title.
Again, he is moving from one jungle to another.
Oh, urban jungle.
The urban jungle.
By the way, the urban scene. That scene where the Latin people come up in a car. How cliched was that? How bad? Yo, man!
Oh, yeah.
You're going to give us the money? You remember?
Of course. And they were boys. I mean, they were very, very young. Also, what was strange about
that
scene. I know you did. I know you did. What was strange about that scene, not to jump around.
Oh,
but,
yeah, sorry.
But no, but they're in a convertible. This is when the Croc is in L.A.
Yes.
Is with...
The Croc.
The Croc.
The Croc. The Croc of shit. That would be better.
Croc is in L.A., and these kids come up to him, and they try to mug him, and then he and his friend disarm them. And then...
Very quickly.
To seal the deal, they're in a convertible, and he lifts up the soft top, and then jumps on it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And then, very odd to me.
That was odd, but I knew the thinking. It's
was,
like, what a nice picture this is. They're all beneath the convertible top, and Paul and with his friend
Paul
jump
and
on
his
too?
Yeah, his friend Jocko.
What is his friend
Jocko? Jocko, not the Jocko from the Energizer commercials, but
not Jocko Michael Jackson.
Not Jocko. Jocko. Yes, there's a lot of Jocko Jockos, but this is his
Jocko
own
was in a famous Italian clown too, in Comedia dell'Arte.
Not the same
not
one.
That guy.
Not that guy.
Yeah, so they jump on that convertible
weird
roof.
But there is a character in this movie named Arlecchino. That's another comedian dell'arte character.
Balloons. That would be funny if they combined.
Arlecchino, Arlecchino.
And then they put a big garbage pail to kind of put a button.
Yes. Just a nice little,
And I was thinking, and this is how bad the movie was. You know how bad a movie is when things like when the big garbage pail goes on top of these kids, these Latin kids, very Latin kids, you're going,
Latin.
Wow.
The kids are very Latin.
Wow, that is a very big garbage pail. Like, those are your thoughts. Instead of having anything interest in the movie, you're like,
that too.
My
it's a
goodness,
giant round.
Where
like,
did they get that?
I had the same thought. I was like, that is a very large garbage pail. And what is it doing in that alley? It looks so clean to be in that alley.
It's not a dumpster.
It's neither dumpster nor garbage can.
But also,
it's some hybrid.
Yeah. It's not a can, it's something other.
Yes. Can I say this? That the movie also had this incredible street cred that it had the badass from Breaking Bad and then
Mike
Aida Totoro from Sopranos.
Yeah.
So they had Sopranos and Breaking Bad strains in this movie.
Well, just to talk about the things that you get confused about in this movie, and this goes to in the terms of the garbage can. There's a scene early in the movie where like him and his wife are talking about going to Los Angeles. By the way, no conflict. No conflict at all.
No.
She's like,
none.
She's like, I want to go to Los Angeles. He's like, okay, great. Like,
yep.
Okay, sure.
This is while they live like in the outback in Australia, basically.
He lives a life where him and an Aborigine pick up their sons from school.
That guy, I mean, like, was that not the weirdest?
That was
like,
the
Aborigine
scene.
Guy is dressed in his, it would be as if he was in America waiting to pick up his son and there was a Native American person who was there in full feather headdress and loincloth.
Yeah.
Like, the Aborigine guy is dressed like traditional, like, Australian Indian garb. It's crazy.
Yeah. But didn't he say he was doing
it? He was a tourist.
He was
doing that as a part of a show.
But
so I assumed he just got
right. But you see, the movie
that
was
makes
so
more sense.
Dull, though. That was so dull that it's easy to miss that.
Oh, I fully missed
it. You start operating at that level. When you're watching this movie, you are lulled completely
to
sleep. I also have had a very hard time, as Paul knows, with the accents in the beginning.
Okay.
I had a very tough time. I don't know what it was. It was maybe specific to that accent, but I genuinely could not hear and I could not understand the words.
The Australian
Were you freaking out?
Junior was like, I can't hear it. We kept on jacking up the volume. But I think, Junior, you have a problem with accents because you have the same problem with like Downton Abbey. And
oh, my
like
God.
Can you do Cockney? Cockney is hard. Like when a real,
like Trainspotting.
Watch,
I think they just
lock,
have a hard time.
Why do one, Eddie? You know how to do accents like that.
Can you get that fork and fling off my feet?
What I said was, there is a great place to go to college in New Hampshire.
See, I didn't
and
get
it's a
that.
Very, yeah, you See, did not get it.
I did not get
it.
Get
it. Was it Dartmouth? Is it the College of Dartmouth?
I don't want to talk about it.
I will say, though, but again, the things that make no sense in this movie. So as they're deciding to leave Australia for no real reason, I guess.
Well, it's about her taking. I thought it was about her getting a job.
Well, her.
This is the crazy thing.
Yeah.
So the setup for her reason to move to LA.
Yeah.
And I'm genuinely asking this because I didn't understand. Is that somebody worked at Newsday in LA?
Newsday.
Her father's paper.
Her father owns
the paper.
That another person who's not her father got into a car accident
and died.
Yeah, and died.
And died.
Yeah.
And who is that man to her?
He is a non-person.
Yes.
He is just the guy that ran that newspaper. And so the dad then turned to her and said, the guy that runs that paper is dead. Will you come and run it for me?
And we never meet her father, though.
Correct.
No.
Crikey, sweetheart.
Why not make that person her dad?
Because we didn't want to make it a sad movie.
It wouldn't be sad. It would have been like more of a reason.
I agree.
Right.
Why not either make the person that dad or have the dad be a character?
Yes,
the plot. Now, here's the thing. Now, I've been getting into old Hollywood lately, like reading stories about Laurel and Hardy, Chaplin, Keaton, all that stuff. And basically, their movies were vehicles for them to do gags. So this was kind of supposedly
like
it's a vehicle to see. But then I was watching the movie. And what were the gags?
Well,
there was the spider in the hat.
Well, this is the one I want to talk about. This is exactly what I was leading to. The spider in the hat.
Yeah, I would say that's a gag.
This is the whole thing.
Yeah.
Because the spider in the hat, to me, I didn't understand what was going on. Like, basically, he's talking to her, and he sees a spider out of the corner of his eye.
Not just a spider, a tarantula.
Tarantula, yes.
In Australia, like a giant venomous tarantula.
And by the way, have we set up that she's scared of spiders?
Well, that's no.
No.
Is he scared? We don't know what's
But she's a woman.
Right. We'll talk about the women in this movie in a second.
But she does. He doesn't like. So he sees it, and it's acting like something. Like this should have been a scene later on when you establish, like, I don't want to live in this house if there are spiders. Yeah. You know, and like, so he's covering the spider in such a way that, you know, he puts it in his hat, and then he puts it, and then spiders in his hat, and then she makes him put on his hat, and then the spiders on his head.
His wife and child are both in the kitchen with a poisonous, deadly spider, and he neither reacts, says anything to them, gets them out of harm's way. He just keeps distracting them from the spider.
And wasn't there an energy that was coming off him that it almost, for a second, I thought, did he bring the spider with him? Is this his
friend's
spider?
No.
Yes.
That wouldn't have made any sense at all.
No, I swear to God, because the look on, but the look on his face was like, oh no, like I've been caught.
I agree. It almost is like when the guy brings like his drunk buddy to the house and then is like, oh shit, my wife is here. Hide over here.
Yes.
It was that, but except that to a spider.
Like, so maybe that's because he does talk to animals. Maybe the spider is his friend.
That's what I'm saying.
And he's like, get it, but then he had to kill his
friend. But here's what I wanted to say, because like the Keaton Chaplin, they had amazing gags for their characters.
Yeah.
The gags here were so weak. Like the
cleaning
biggest...
the bear trap. He's even at the kitchen sink cleaning, and then he's like, bear trap, or maybe gator trap. I don't know.
I even missed that.
Oh yeah, he pulls a gator like a trap.
What he's doing in the kitchen is washing an animal trap, like a very archaic kind of like metal snap trap. Like that's the other thing, is he's washing a trap that definitely causes huge amounts of harm to animals.
Right. I was there was a couple of things like that. Like
there were a few gags
stony.
That I liked, though. I liked when he killed the fake snake at Jungle
World. I liked
that,
too.
I laughed out loud.
Me, too.
I liked when he was talking to the two dads who were waiting to pick up their kids.
That was
about
funny.
Killing
a
boar.
I thought that was good.
Like, there were some gags. And by the way, Crocodile Dundee 1, those gags worked.
They did. I did not see.
The 7 year old.
Wait,
the 7 year old version of me.
I was just going to say. Have you seen it
since
you were 7?
No, I haven't seen it.
Oh, that's true. I would wonder if those would hold up for you.
I feel like they would.
I don't know, because I agree with you, Eddie. Like, I feel like the gags here were just sort of like, all right.
Well, that's
what
why
else?
We were laughing at the snake gag when he stabbed the snake, because comparatively, that was funny.
But
it wasn't hilarious.
Well, here's the thing. There's a thing with Crocodile Dundee, is sometimes his intelligence level is at an all-time high.
Oh yeah.
And other times it's at a groundbreakingly
low. Okay, here's
low
an example
on
for
the
me.
Spectrum side. Yeah.
For me, here's an example of where I was like, whoa, what is happening right now? Wherein he and his son are driving, and his son says, "Oh look, Dad, look, there's a dog in the road." So Crocodile Dundee hits the brakes on his Subaru Outback, by the way.
I love Subaru that he's driving Outback. An Outback. By the way, he was a spokesperson for Outback at that time, so that's why he had to be driving it.
He hits the brakes on his Subaru Outback, comes to a screeching halt, okay?
Yes.
At which point, all of the freeway traffic, they're on the freeway. They're all of the
they're
freeway
like on
traffic.
The 405.
Yes. Basically, the freeway then turns into like a 24 car, both almost pile up.
But Jason, this is like hammering home the point. We are now in LA.
Yeah.
The traffic is horrible.
Crazy.
And Mr. Australian is stopping to save a dog, which
and
has turned out
but
to
this
be
is
a
the
skunk.
Thing. Like, he goes like this. He's like, it's like, right. All like an 18 wheeler, blah, blah, everything. Yeah. And then he just says to his son, "Where's the dog?" Like he just says, he's not. It's as if he's not aware of the fact.
But and then I'll go even one step further.
He's so stupid in this.
Fucking
scene.
Helicopters and police things are surrounding him, and he doesn't know even looking up. Nothing.
He's walking around the middle of the freeway holding a skunk, which he thinks is a dog.
By the way,
slash
what
cat.
Paul just pointed out was why the movie is so flat. Is because it just exists in this world that he kind of just walks through with no emotion. He has no emotion, and we as the audience have absolutely no emotion.
Yeah.
So it's just a flat line.
Well,
the
but
whole
here's
thing.
A weird, really weird thing about that scene. So he doesn't know what a skunk is.
And that is what we're meant to believe.
He
does make a point to say we don't have those back home, but he's an animal expert. He would know what a skunk is.
No, I don't think he's an animal expert. I think that he is good with animals that are around him. Right. Because I don't think
he's good with the skunk.
Well, he's very good with the skunk.
Here's what's also strange, though, about him going to save the dog is that, and maybe I was reading too much into it, but it's like if he's somebody who is used to animals being in the wild, what was he saving that dog from?
The cars.
Well, the cars.
The cars.
I guess it was just on the highway.
Okay, fine. So he was going to save the dog. Here's the other crazy thing about this
scene.
I have a question about this. The police, the LAPD think that it's a bomb.
Well, because someone says when they pull out, someone casually just says, I think he has a bomb. And then that was a game of telephone.
Right, he said it's a dog. And then it was a game of telephone as it gets communicated back through traffic. And then somebody says, I think he said there's a bomb. And then somebody goes, he's going to blow it up. And then everybody, chaos ensues.
But my question is, you know, the whole movie is his experience in L.A. And sort of they hit a lot of the, like, the Los Angeles, the stereotypical like Los Angeles.
Yeah. Oh, my God. I want to talk about landmarks. the roller skater on Venice.
Oh, yeah. We got to that clip, by the way.
The crazy thing is, well, what I was wondering is, were bomb scares at that time?
Yeah.
Well, freeway shootings, maybe, or maybe that. No, I don't think it's trading
on any kind of cultural, you know, like situation. I think
what year did it come out?
2001.
2001.
Before September 11th. It was.
But the other strange thing, though, is when that news footage is playing later on, and he's in the house with his wife, and he's so embarrassed because they're showing it on TV that he caused this thing. But I genuinely don't understand why he was embarrassed, because the LAPD should be the ones who are embarrassed about thinking it was a bomb.
No, no, no. I don't think he's embarrassed. He doesn't want his wife to know. He says to the kid on the highway, he goes, best not to tell your mom this happened.
Man talk.
You know?
Man talk.
But well, wait,
but can I want to bring up the one thing that we're not talking about, which is, I think, the more disturbing thing about everything in this scene, which is when it is clearly established he has a skunk in his arms and he approaches the cops, the cops pull guns to shoot him.
Yeah.
Because they don't want to get sprayed, which is an overreaction.
I mean, that is a heavy overreaction. Justifiable self-defense.
If somebody was walking towards you with a skunk, and could the LAPD shoot that person?
Is there a standard ground law as far as skunks?
He was wearing the skunk like a hoodie.
And this is in the age of Rodney. You know, I guess Rodney King. You know, so maybe these cops are a little bit more.
But I mean, Rodney King, 9/11. This is deeper than I thought.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
I didn't know there was such overtones and undertones.
This is post Waco. I mean, I'm getting a lot of like
post Waco.
I just want to talk about the Beverly Hills Cop part of this movie.
Oh, like the art heist, like procedural?
Yeah.
That was so...
And it like was introduced real late in the game.
Really late. Like the main plot of the movie isn't introduced until like an hour into it.
Right. At least.
And it's then the movie is like an hour and 28 minutes.
Yeah.
And I don't even quite understand what it is. It's like they're
me neither.
The bad guys, the guy from Dear John and the guy from Breaking Bad.
Jerry Burns.
Yes, thank you. They have come across hundreds of millions of dollars worth of art that was in Yugoslavia that was thought destroyed.
But did they destroy a war crime, by the way? Right.
Which, by the way, was hilarious to me that all of a sudden there's this serious issue.
Like a political.
Yes!
Yeah.
Like all of a sudden we're talking about war crimes in times of war, which was a big thing when the U.S. invaded Iraq. There were burnings of fucking museums.
Yeah, totally.
Heavy duty stuff. Yeah. And all of a sudden in this vanilla as hell movie that's introduced.
Yeah, it's war profiteering is basically what it is. And so they find these paintings in Yugoslavia, and their method of bringing them into the United States was to start a movie studio that makes movies in Yugoslavia and then brings the paintings back as props.
It was so confusing to me as well.
Yeah.
And here's the thing, and again, this is my problem with the movie. There was not one iota of tension about any of that.
No.
So it's sort of like you just have to go in your head, okay, that's the bad guy, because you really don't know.
Well, the other thing is, these bad guys are bad news because they killed this newspaper reporter.
Right.
They killed someone to keep their. But my question is, were they selling this art? Because at one point, like Jerry Burns goes, yeah, if they don't want to buy it, we'll burn it on screen. It's like, what does that mean?
I know.
Like,
this is what I couldn't figure out at the end of the movie. So, like, these guys are bad guys who run a movie studio, and it's Paramount. It's the Paramount lot.
Yes,
is their lot. So they shoot on the Paramount lot.
I think they wouldn't need a lot of money.
As if it's this thing, right? So So at the end of the movie, they're like, these paintings are said to be worth at least $300 million. Okay. If you have enough money to have the Paramount lot and you're making huge budget action movies, you need way more than $300 million. $300 million is insignificant money to people who are running a studio that big.
It is a giant studio, and they were like a micro-budget thing, but I didn't...
I didn't get it.
I didn't understand, like, also, why did they have to keep on making sequels to unsuccessful movies? Like,
I think to keep going back to Yugoslavia.
Couldn't they just make another movie and
I don't know.
But
I wish
the way,
I knew.
How he, you know.
Tornado Chasers 2? Sorry.
Yeah, I know. Oh, by the way, when he does his like Pee Wee Herman running through the sets.
Yeah.
The sets are so cheapo.
Yeah.
I mean, they are
terrible.
Really bad.
They're cartoon bad.
But another horrible thing is when he finally does get the bad guys. You know, he beats the bad guys at the end with animals.
Oh, yeah.
And I noticed that a couple of the animals look sickly. I don't know if you did, but I'm a big animal lover.
Yeah.
And the lion.
I hate him.
A lot of people don't care about him.
You know what? I wanted to see him
shoot
those animals.
A lot of people eat them. Yeah. A lot of people eat them. Anyway.
Are you a vegetarian, Eddie Pimentone?
I'm a vegan.
You are. Oh, wow. Yeah. I am fascinating.
That is fascinating for me.
For how long?
For about a year now.
Oh, okay. So,
but it's a big deal for me, and like a consciousness that has totally gotten into my life. And one of the lions
the second one who came out looked very sick.
I was like, this is not a badass lion. This looks like a lion in captivity that's not doing well.
Yeah. Well, the
and
lion
thought it was just another.
Well, the lion doesn't roar or anything. She just keeps moving her head.
Pained.
Moving her head as a vegan, oddly.
As a vegan. I was looking
like
at
probably lab. Trying to shake off whatever anesthetic they've given her.
Yes.
Like just like shaking her head like, why am I so groggy? I'm a lion.
Yes. I mean, and also just the fact that the whole movie is based on the concept that when they're not shooting the scenes with the lions, that they stay on set in cages in the in the stages.
Oh yeah.
Like they're just in cages on
That's
the
stages.
That's
what we're to presume. Like, all right, we're gonna lock up the studio for the night, put the lions in the cage that they live in this studio where there's nobody looking after them.
And there's also that thing where Paul Hogan becomes the animal trainer on the set, and he's given that job so freely. So like
it was
like,
God, how about when he's an extra in that movie
with Paul Rodriguez. Yeah, Paul Rodriguez.
And they're walking down their background, they're just walking down the street and the main guy is running towards them.
Yes.
And Paul Hogan clotheslines him.
Well,
and then Paul Rodriguez goes, oh,
he just
tripped.
Helping him up.
He tripped. We were just trying to catch him. And the guy who he clotheslined high fives Paul Hogan is like, thanks, man.
That made no sense.
Paul Hogan very clearly on film clotheslines this guy.
And by the way, that's another example of Paul Hogan being really dumb. He gets that he's in a movie. He gets that he's an extra in a movie. But yet he hurts this guy.
Yeah.
So that's a lot.
Amazing.
Today's podcast is obviously about Crocodile Dundee 3, Crocodile Dundee in Los Angeles, and we felt that we would be remiss if we did not have someone from this movie, and we have the writer of this movie, Matthew Berry, who you know from ESPN. He has a brand new book called Fantasy Life. It is available right now. You can go to fantasylifethebook.com to pick up the book. Please welcome Matthew Berry. How are you, Matthew?
I'm good. I cannot tell you how excited I am to be talking about this movie.
I am blown away, because let's just first get this out. Crocodile Dundee came out in 1986. Crocodile Dundee 3 came out 15 years later. When you were approached with this project, because I imagine this was not a spec script, were you like, were you surprised that this is something that people were interested in? How did you get involved in the Crocodile Dundee franchise 15 years later?
Well, of course. My writing partner and I were busy working on our Gremlins 4 spec when they called up. It's interesting. So I was a sitcom writer, and I'd written on a bunch of sitcoms. My writing partner and I, and we'd just gotten off, a sitcom had just been canceled. We were on Union Square, which was another, if you ever do a sitcom version of How Did This Get Made, I'll tell you about Union Square. But so anyway, the show, of course, gets canceled. So our agent calls us. We'd been talking about getting into movies, but we hadn't even written a spec or anything yet. And our agent calls us, and he says, "You guys want to get into movies, right?" "Yes." He says, "Well, you know who Paul Hogan is?" "Of course." "You ever seen Crocodile Dundee?" "Of course."
Wait, right. If you know who Paul Hogan is, you've seen Crocodile Dundee.
Of course.
There is
right.
No...
That's true. How else do you know who he is?
Well, I'm a fan of his other work.
Right, sure.
He was in Showa.
I haven't seen the Croc movies, but Flipper. I loved him in Flipper. Right, of course.
Like, it was so funny. Looking at his IMDb page last night, I was like, I almost feel like we could do a whole month on Paul Hogan movies.
Oh, my
like,
God.
Lightning Jack, where like Cuba Gooding Jr. plays a mute.
What?
Yeah.
Oh, we gotta do that. We should do that and radio.
Oh my God.
Back to back Cuba Gooding Jr. movies.
I love that. That's a live show.
Well, Hogan likes animals, right?
But well, he can talk to them because he can talk to them.
And this is like,
anyway,
yes.
But that's the whole point, right? So he says, you know, he's like, "Well, I'm one of the agents in charge." Paul Hogan is a client at the agency, wants to do a third installment of the franchise. "I'm one of the agents in charge of putting writers in a room to pitch him ideas for the movie. If you want, I'll throw you in a room with him and you can, you know, get some practice." And
yeah,
my writing partner and I, like, you know, screw it. Let's meet Paul Hogan. That'll be a funny story.
Yeah, of course.
You know, this is sort of a backstory here. Paul Hogan owns like 60% of the movie.
Oh,
like, Paul
wow.
Hogan was Paul Hogan was a TV star. Like, he had a variety show in Australia. So he's a TV star, and with a couple of writers from the variety show, he wrote the first one and cobbled together like $5 million from investors to make the first movie, made on a shoestring budget, and he owned it. So he owned like 60% of it, and then he went around piecemeal to all the different countries and just sold the distribution rights.
Whoa.
So, I mean, he made gazillions of...
So, yeah, he's a rich, rich dude, yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
And now, it is still 14 years later, though, you're going into pitch. It's a little, I mean, were you a little bit struck by that? Like, why now? I mean, because it's a long gap.
I honestly think he wanted to be a star again.
Mm.
And frankly, I think he wanted his wife to do something.
Oh, right, because he's married
to... never worked again.
Oh, that's his
and
wife?
That was,
yes.
No.
Yes, that's his wife.
That's no.
He's a lot younger.
No.
And he had...
Jude. No.
Are you okay?
Because, okay, Matthew, the one thing I was going to say is they didn't seem to have 1 ounce of gas. Those were the stiffest scenes.
It was, oh, yeah.
By the way,
I am genuinely shocked.
Not only
is this
his wife, but he had a very, very public divorce in Australia, like in the tabloids
with
and everything.
With this woman?
Because he cheated on his wife with Linda Kozlowski or whatever her name is. And
wait, no, his other wife with this woman, you mean?
The Linda, the one in the movie, yes.
Yes,
he cheated on
his mistress.
He went through fire to have this love that could not be contained.
Please tell me that's their real son.
We never, no. It's weird, in writing the movie, I mean, we're jumping all over the place, but just as you talk about it, so there were a couple of times where he had a house in Santa Barbara, and when we would go up and pitch him various things for the movies or go over things with him, we never met her. She was always around, but like it was just weird. You know, we would go to this guy's house for, there were like two or three days where we spent like the entire day with him, pitching him ideas, and he'd say yes to some stuff and no to some stuff.
"I want you to stay out of the picture, sweetheart. Make yourself busy in the kitchen."
Now you know why we asked Eddie Pepitone to be on this podcast. A flawless, known
well, I
the world
was just
over
in
for
Melbourne, so
flawless
I have the accent.
Paul Hogan impression.
So, I mean, it honestly felt like that. There were the only two rules that we had.
Okay.
The only two, you know, we were told to go pitch, and we were like, it had to take place present day.
Got it.
Which means, you know, we couldn't, like, go back in time and, like, do it, like, you know, 2 years after the... had to take place present day, and she had to be in it. Everything else was up for grabs.
Okay.
So we go in, and we rewatch the first two movies, And you know what? What we realize is they're very simple movies. Obviously, it's just him reacting to stuff. Like that's the whole movie, right?
Yeah.
And he's funniest when he's reacting to stuff. So we're like, and we don't want this job. We don't think we're getting it. So we basically, the premise we come up with is this: we come up with it in maybe half a day. We're just like, we go in and we say, like, look, you did New York in the first two movies. You've never done L.A. Let's say you're moving, you're living in Australia, you're still with Linda, but let's say you've never been married, but you've got a little kid. So he's like, he's a little croc.
Right.
Because there was the other thing is, I don't know if you guys remember when this movie came out, but basically, like, Something About Mary was like the big movie, at least at the time we were pitching it. Something About Mary was like the big movie in Hollywood, and all the things that were getting sold and made were like these raunchy R-rated comedies.
Right.
Really sort of over-the-top, Fairly Brother-type movies, and we were like, there's no way this movie can compete with that. So the only shot it has is to try to go the other way and just be like super family and friendly and, you know, sweet that the people that enjoyed the first one could take their kids to.
Sure. Was there any...
like made for me.
Exactly. We pitch them that simple story of like, hey, you go to L.A., there's some bad guys. You get a job at the studio because you can talk to the animals. Your wife gets a job at, like, you know, Newsday in L.A. You're going to show your, because your kid's never been to America, so you're going to show him around. It's the blind leading the blind because you're telling him you know America, but obviously you don't. I said, it's mostly, there's going to be some bad guys at the studio. You save the day, but most of the movie is you walking around L.A.
Which everybody does. Everybody does, walks around L.A.
It is funny, like, the amount of times that they drive past and then are back out in front of Hollywood Boulevard. They're always going down Hollywood Boulevard, and it seems like they've driven away, and then they're right, and they're walking around the corner, and they're at like the Guinness Book of World Records Museum.
Right. So, yeah, yes. Exactly. Right. I mean.
So yeah. So you're basically taking the formula.
I think they had 2 days to shoot in L.A. or something like that. So basically, we just said that. We said that's the movie, and then you end with a wedding because everybody loves a wedding.
The right. L.A. montage was electric, by the way. It made me want to go out on the streets. I just wanted to.
Of course.
You couldn't believe you had it all available to you.
So now all three of you are listed as writers. So did he get in the mix and writer? Was he just supervising you two?
No, he's not listed as a writer. That's part of the whole dispute. So anyway, okay. So just to put a bow on this. So basically, so we give him that pitch, and it's like that's simple. It's just super simple. Like, you go to L.A., blah, blah, blah. There's bad guys there. You walk around L.A. It's Crocodile Dundee. We'll make it funny. You know, how tough is it? And he's like, you guys are the only ones who get me.
Oh, my, like, God.
Awesome.
Right? It's like the producers. Like,
are you
like
kidding
pitching
me?
Something.
Yeah. Like, we have no thoughts that we're ever getting this job. We are literally going in because we think it'll be a funny story to tell. Hey, we met Paul Pogan, and, you know, it was practice to pitch, you know, pitch to a movie star or something like that. And apparently everyone else, every other writer he met with pitched him, like, Crocodile Dundee saves the universe from a nuclear explosion, Croc 3 in space, like all these like crazy terrible ideas. And we were the only ones.
So you're saying Croc 3 in space is terrible?
And you react to them.
I do want to see Croc 3 in space, by the way.
By the way, that would be great.
Croc 4. I will pay you $500 to write that.
That would be the sequel to Sharknado.
That would be amazing.
All right, so now you're trapped. You're in.
Yeah, well, I mean, they basically, so he wants to, it becomes one of these things where he wants to co-write it with us, and so because Paul's writing quote is so insanely high, people don't realize
Academy Award
got an Academy Award nomination for writing for the first movie.
Paul Hogan got an Academy Award.
He got an Academy for writing the first movie?
Crocodile Dundee 1?
Yep.
Yep. It did not win, but he
was nominated.
Him and the two other guys that wrote the first movie, and I don't know who contributed what to that, but the three.
June Love.
Paul Hogan is an Academy Award nominee for the screenplay of
You are blowing my mind.
And a Golden Globe winner for Best Actor.
That's mind-boggling.
Yeah.
And a Razzie nominee for Crocodile Dundee in Los Angeles, along with me. Thank you very much.
Nice.
We got screwed. I thought we should have won.
Who did you lose to in that year's Razzies?
We lost to, just a random story. My writing partner and I were represented at Endeavor at the time.
Right.
And we literally asked our agent, you know how like in the trades back then, you'd see all these big ads, you know, CAA congratulates its client, or William Morris congratulates its client, so and so on, his Academy Award nomination. And we were like, hey, Endeavor, we want you to take on an ad, like, you know, Endeavor congratulates, you know, Matthew Barry and Eric Abrams on their Razzie nomination. Because I thought that would have been hilarious.
That's amazing.
They would not do it.
They would not do
Cowards.
It. We lost to Planet of the Apes for worst remake or sequel.
Yes.
Oh.
Mark Wahlberg, Planet of the Apes.
He deserved it.
So anyway, so yeah, so but because Paul's writing quote was so high, what Paramount was going to pay us to do this movie was insane amount of money for first time movie writers.
Yeah.
So we were like,
you must have been happy about that.
Yeah.
Well, exactly. Like, if you're going to sell out big.
Yeah. Really?
All the kids out there.
But at that point, I mean, you've got those Union Square dollars.
The sweet, seven sweet square dollars.
Yeah. So, I mean, listen, so we did it. We, you know, and Alyssa bought me a house. God bless Croc.
Sure.
For that.
So now you're signed up. You got a lot of money. You are. You're off to do this movie. So now, what is this process like? As you embark on the action. Yeah.
Right. So the plan was for us to, quote, write it together. But the last thing my writing partner and I want to do is sit in front of a computer screen with Paul Hogan for 3 months, right? And we know he doesn't want to do that either.
Mm-hmm.
So we say to him, look, let us write the first draft. We'll run everything by you and everything like that. We'll write the first draft, and then we'll hand it to you, and you can take your pass at it, and we'll go from there. So we go off, and we write our script, and, you know, we pitch him a bunch of stuff, and some stuff he likes, and some stuff he doesn't, and he gave us notes and whatever. And
give me an example. Do you remember, like, something that he liked, something he didn't like? Do you remember anything that you're like, oh, I wish we would have gotten that in, like that? Do you remember anything like that?
Yeah, I mean... Yes. I mean, here's one thing that we pitched that he didn't like that I thought would be funny, that I thought was a very kind of Crocodile Dundee type thing.
Right.
I mean, remember, it's all sort of gentle humor, right?
Sure.
It's all sort of observational, gentle humor that he's reacting. He's a guy from the Outback. But, like, you know how, like, when you're in L.A., everyone valets.
Right.
Right? You go, no matter where you valet, you can't just find any parking. And when you get a valet ticket, it says, read this. You know, and it's all the disclaimer stuff on the ticket.
That's funny, yeah.
So we thought it would be funny if Paul Hogan actually reads it. But, like, you know, there's a long line of cars and everything like that, and he gets there. You know, of course, everyone just takes the ticket and walks off, and they go. But, you know, it literally says, limits your liability. And so he won't give the keys until he's read the whole thing, and he's considering it. And people are honking, and everyone's going nuts, and he's just, hold on, I'm thinking about this, you know? And so it was just, it was the whole thing
right.
that he just doesn't understand.
A funny piece.
No, I think he was right to deny that.
There is still a valet joke in this. There is the valet joke
where he attacks the valet, yeah.
Right, and that's what it turned into.
Sometimes, we were talking about this, Croc is violent. Sometimes he's very much a pacifist, and sometimes he's very much aware of things, and sometimes he's very much unaware of things. Like, did he have rules for the Croc character? Like, because he goes to punch that valet real quick, but then you see that he seems like he's a pacifist most of the time.
There were no rules. I think it was just whatever worked for Paul.
All right.
He would say sometimes, like, I wouldn't do that.
Got it.
But he never seemed to really say, like, oh, Crocodile Dundee does A, but he doesn't do B. He
Got
never
it.
Sat down.
Right.
It was all sort of in his mind.
He didn't have the Crocodile Dundee Bible that he passed off.
No, we didn't get that. We didn't get the secret handshake.
He wasn't that detailed.
So you write the first draft, and then what happens here?
So we write the, whatever, we write the first draft based on, you know, his notes, everything like that. And so basically he then rewrites pretty much the entire script. He throws a couple of new things in there. But generally, and this is the example I give, so let's say we're doing a scene like, we wrote a scene like sort of like interior podcast studio.
Right.
Matthew's talking to Paul Scheer. Matthew Berry is talking to Paul Scheer about his movie. Okay?
Yes.
You know, Paul, Matthew, welcome to the show. And he would rewrite that
this
to say,
movie
like,
is amazing.
Interior TV studio. You know, Nick Kroll is interviewing Eric Abrams.
Oh, wow. So he was just going through and just changing names so he can get credit. So he was trying to steal writer's credit from you, essentially.
Correct. I mean, so not there's not one word that's the same. So, like, you know,
but the intention is all the same.
Two different guys, and they're talking about his book. And so it's like a college kid, you know, changing his term paper,
right.
You know, from Wikipedia or something.
Oh, man. That's really
so he
low
could justify his writing it, huh?
Right, exactly, and just everything was just sort of like a worse version of what we had.
So, I mean,
You know what I mean? It's just like every punchline was just like not nearly as sharp. It wasn't as funny. It's just more obvious.
There you go. There you go. I think it's all fixed.
You know, I think there was like something like I think, you know, we at least try. I mean, I don't know. Like, we're starting with a 16-year-old sequel, right? And it's Croc 3. But, like, we at least tried to make it at least semi-smart sort of things. Like,
sure.
I think the gay bar scene, I think the gay bar scene that we had was he goes into the gay bar, has a drink, and has a great time.
Got it.
I think that would have been there, funny. But
yeah.
Has no
I
idea
think that would have been
that they're
funny.
Gay.
Yeah. Because he runs out like right away, like you, it would, or even him with a bunch of women cross dressing, he didn't get that they were not that they were men.
Well,
and,
his friend didn't get that the host was a cross dresser.
Yeah, he actually did get that.
Yes, he did.
Yeah. He did get that. He was
he looked
on to
the camera, going, "That's his problem."
Right, exactly. Like, we didn't want to make fun of, like, we thought it would be funnier if he's just like, "I met the greatest group of guys."
I
like,
think
just
that
had
would
no
have been
concept
funny, yeah.
of what was yeah. going on in the scene. We thought that was
yes.
That was
I think
the
you're
character.
Right. I think Croc works best when he's sort of joyfully innocent.
Yeah, where he's like truly a fish out of water.
Yes.
Right, and has sort of this in the first movie he has like a super positive outlook, you know,
yes.
on everything, and it's literally like, and you know, jokes aside, the most, you know, obviously the most famous scene, it's not even a threatening, like, you know, it's like, that's not a knife, this is a knife,
right
and it's not an angry thing, it's a bragging thing,
right,
it's
yeah.
like he's just pushing it aside.
By the way, Matthew, you know, in our very cynical world, I think we need Croc 4.
Can I tell you something hilarious?
Yeah.
Our agent, we actually had a great agent on this particular deal. Our agent, we actually have a contract when we agreed to do it. If there is a Croc 4, he has to offer it to us first.
Amazing.
We still have the rights of first refusal on Croc 4.
Well, you know, Matthew, you might be getting that because I'm looking at this article on IMDb that says that his money manager stole $34 million from him.
What?
No.
Yes.
I saw that. He's having some tax problems, too. You know what's amazing is that $34 million probably doesn't mean that much to him.
Wow.
He's literally that wealthy.
Wow.
That is
which
mind-boggling.
Which is why the guy could steal it,
Well, I mean, it says here that yeah he allegedly helped him hide money in a Swiss account in order to avoid taxes.
Oh, geez.
And he made off with $34 million of it. And Australia has a warrant out for Philip Eagleshaw, who is behind this country's largest tax evasion scheme.
Crikey!
There's the plot.
There is the plot. He's
oh,
got
there
a
you
plot.
Go.
Croc in Switzerland.
Croc in Switzerland.
That's amazing.
Can I ask you, Matt, can I ask you about the spider in the hat scene?
Yes, we were curious about the spider in the hat scene.
Because it's been a long time. I should have watched it again in anticipation of this podcast.
How dare
I've been
you?
On this book tour and I haven't.
Well, he sees a spider in the room.
Like a tarantula.
A tarantula.
In his
right.
kitchen.
And he seems very scared by it, and he doesn't want to show his wife that it's there, and he kind of scoops it up in his hat. But we don't know why.
I think what was confusing to us is it almost seemed like the intention that was coming across was like, oh, the reaction on his face was one of, oh, one of my friends is here, and he's not supposed to be here. Or he felt guilt or something that the spider was there.
Do you remember the
Do
spider?
Do you remember anything about that?
This might have been Apollo.
We didn't
special.
Do that. That was all Mr. Hogan's genius.
Okay.
So
there is a number of scenes in this movie where a deadly animal is present. Paul Hogan is safe. Somebody else is in harm's way, and he does not warn them. Like, because
yeah.
there's also the scene where the big giant Jaws croc eats Paul Hogan's boat. He gets up in a tree, and then his buddy comes Jocko comes along in a tiny little canoe, and is like, "What are you doing up in the tree?" And Paul Hogan's like, "Oh, don't worry about it." And then he doesn't warn him. Isn't like there's a gigantic croc, and the croc eats Jocko's boat. Jocko easily could have gotten eaten in that scene. Was there any
you
effort?
Could have,
yeah, go ahead.
And you would have. I was just going to say, you would think in the Australian outback, because that's where Jacko lives, that he's aware of this.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, now you alluded to the fact that he's kind of a jerk. So when did the jerk side pop out?
The jerk side comes out. So we turn in the movie. He rewrites it the way he does, where he just basically makes everything like much more obvious and much more dull and, you know, and whatever.
It's all fixed
look,
now.
It's never going to be a great movie, but we were trying to make it at least slightly clever.
Right,
right.
And were you writing, and just to derail you for one second, were you writing to cameos too? Because I know like Mike Tyson's in this movie and
George Hamilton.
Were you guys, was that a mandate in here too? Or that just was like a,
yes.
Okay, great.
Yes, but
that looked like a mandate.
But it was a mandate to write cameos, but you know, it was always like generic because they're like, we'll see who we can get.
Mike Tyson was a questionable one at that point because that would be right after he got out of jail for allegedly raping that girl, right?
Yes. Yeah, that was a very surprising one.
Yeah,
he was a very gentle.
We actually wanted Hef. We wrote in Hef.
That makes sense.
You know, and at one point he gets basically a Hef lookalike or something
right,
like that.
Right, right.
But yes, so that was one of the ideas. I think that was one of the pitches is that he would run into celebrities and not know who any of them were. That
right.
was an LA thing. That he would run into celebrities.
Like just like way. Doing normal celebrity stuff, like Mike Tyson, everybody always knows, is always meditating in a park in Beverly Hills.
Right, by himself.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah. Everybody knows that.
Excuse me, mister. What are you doing?
Well, I'm meditating, young man.
What's meditating?
Meditating is a special place I go in my mind where there's no distraction and I receive a great source of power.
Cool. Can you show us how, please?
Sure. Come forward and have a seat.
My name's Mikey. What's yours?
Hey, Mike. I'm Mike.
Hi, Mike. I'm Mick. Mikey's dad.
Mikey, Mick, Mike. You gotta be kidding me, right? Okay. Hold your legs, like in a boot up position. Grab your ankles to save yourself from some discomfort. And we're going to take it easy, close the eyes, relax. Inhale the positivity. Exhale the negativity. Inhale the positivity. Exhale the negativity.
And the Mel Gibson stuff, which I did like. That to me was like a perfect example of like a Croc One, like, you know.
Tom Cruise, what does he look like?
Yeah, like I like those jokes. Yeah. Sorry, so now he... Now
is it true Mel Gibson doesn't like the Jews?
Right, that was in the first draft.
so, all right, so now you hand in the script, it's watered down, and now he becomes a jerk. How is
right,
it
because so whatever, it's fine. So he does it, but basically he then takes our name off the script. And
wow,
we need to have. So he turns it in, and he wants sole writing credit.
Wow!
Again, this is a guy who is this is Crocodile Dundee in Los Angeles, Croc 3,
yeah.
Produced by Paul Hogan, based on characters created by Paul Hogan, starring Paul Hogan. He's in every frame of the movie, Paul Hogan.
Yeah,
but he still needs sole writing credit. And.
Wow.
It would have been fine with us. It's not like we were proud of it.
Right.
The problem was is that because of the contract we'd signed, and you know, anyone listening that's a member of the Writers Guild, like to get residuals
and certain contractual
bonuses, we needed to have writing credit.
Yeah.
Like we were going to get a bonus if it got made and we had writing credit, or at least partial writing credit. So we needed to have writing credit because the whole reason we wrote the damn thing was for money. You know, it was a pure money gig, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
So once Paul Hogan basically said, I want sole writing credit, the line was drawn in the sand, and it was either us or him for writing credit.
Oh, man. So you had to go against him and fight him for...
You had to arbitrate against him.
Did you have to go, sit there in arbitration with him, or you went separately?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So,
not a pen. This is a pen.
Right. That's not a first draft. Yeah. This is a first draft. Right. So, right. And we go and... We turn in our draft to the Writers Guild, and we have to make our presentation to a 3-person board. He does the same thing. He turns in his draft of the second version of the script.
Yeah.
And then they look at the final shooting script. And because he's a producer on the movie, he needed to have created 50% of the movie. Like, that's the sort of the Writers Guild, at least at the time, that was the rule. And basically, he loses. He loses 3-0. They vote for us.
Wow.
Amazing.
So he then appeals the decision, which is allowed. The appeal goes through. He loses 3-0 again.
He could have just shut his mouth and shared screenwriting credit and made more money.
Yeah. We never would have fought it. We turned it in, actually. The first draft of the script that we turned in had all 3 of our names written by the three of us.
So he just was trying to get more money. That's crazy. Yeah. So now
I don't even think it was money. I think it's literally ego. I think the whole reason why he wanted to be a star again. He wanted to be in a universe where you know, hey, this we're making another Croc movie. He's the big star. He's got the big trailer. It's all about him.
It's kind of like the Sylvester Stallone. His name is on like every movie as a writer. And I'm looking at Paul Hogan's IMDb page, and he wrote Lightning Jack, Almost an Angel. He's listed as a writer on every one of his movies.
Right. So that's sort of his thing or whatever. So now he's lost 9-0. He's lost the appeal. He's lost the appeal of the appeal. So we're like, okay. So then he starts threatening to sue the Writers Guild. And he starts doing all the press.
Whoa.
And he's trashing us in public. Like, if you search for Paul, if you Google, like, yeah. Paul Hogan sues Writers Guild, or Paul Hogan, you know, Crocodile Dundee in Los Angeles, WGA, or anything like that, you'll see he talks about wanting to sue the Writers Guild for writing credit, and that he really wrote it, and that these two guys, Matthew Barron and Eric Abrams, don't deserve credit and everything like that. So now we're in this, like, really public battle about this movie that we're not real proud of. Like, you know, we want screen credit for the movie. But it's one of those things that's like, maybe you date somebody that you're not real proud of.
Yeah.
You're at a place and you're like, look, I need some companionship, but really don't want to publicize this too much.
Yeah, yeah,
sort of
yeah.
Thing. Mm. We've all been in relationships right?
Sure.
Where we're dating a horrible person that we want our friends to not know about, and we want to keep them secret.
Yeah.
So we tell everybody we don't know them.
Right.
Correct.
Yeah,
so
yeah,
this
yeah,
is
yeah.
the thing. Like, we didn't want, like,
yeah,
we didn't
yeah,
want
we're
like,
all horrible
the
people, right, Matthew?
We're the Croc 3 writers.
Yeah, you're right, of course.
Yes.
We wanted screen credit for, so we could make the money.
Yeah,
so now we're in
house.
This big public dispute where we literally have to get up and fight very publicly. Yes, we wrote the movie, not Paul. You know what I mean? Like, we can't sit there and say we didn't write. You know what I mean? Like, it's this horrible, awkward thing where we have to very publicly say, like, no, we're the writers of this horrible, shitty movie. You know what I mean? Like,
and we're fighting to be the writers.
Right, exactly. We are fighting to get credit for this terrible movie.
Right.
Oh, that was the. Oh, that's the hilarious thing too. Is when the poster first came out, and when it said written by, it said pending.
Oh, that's
names
funny.
On there initially.
That's awesome.
Oh my god.
A lot of people are like, "Who's pending?"
And then
who's pending?
Pending
who
is really
pending. I want to read more from this.
Yeah,
it's like directed by pending. Alan Smithy. It's like a fake name that they put when they don't know.
Did you guys ever have a face off at all? Like, did you?
Sort of. I mean, you know, we went to the premiere, and you know, they were like contractually obligated to give us like 4 tickets, 2 each for the premiere, and like they're the last 2 seats. Like the rest of the cast and the director and everything, they're all like front and center. We were literally in the last row in the back corner. Like you go to the premiere, like they wouldn't let us walk the red carpet. And then it's just, you know, it's just a horrible, horrible experience because we're just treated like pariahs. And you know, the guy that was sort of whoever was the lowest person at Paramount got stuck with handling us. And he's just like, yeah, sorry, Paul Hogan said, you know, you guys can't be anywhere near him. And you know, like really. Because
wow.
We want, I don't know, you know, so yeah. It was just a horrible experience from start to finish. And he was such a terrible human being to us. And
and he was such a liar because you wrote the damn thing. So he was living this lie.
And he knew that he was living a lie.
Christ.
So do you come face to face with him?
At one point we ran into him after the movie. We were exiting at the same time he was or something like that.
Uh-oh.
And we're like, and I think I said something, I was like, hey, I literally said, hey, Paul, gosh, the movie turned out swell. Like, I said something really like that, and he just looked at me, and he didn't say anything. He walked on.
Wow.
You know?
Wow.
What a dick.
Yeah.
Now, do your children play with his children these days?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Great friends. I'm working on Croc 4 now.
Your children have like a Romeo and Juliet, like star-crossed lovers scenario happening.
But then this is basically what took you from the world of writing TV and film into writing a very successful fantasy football column and giving you all your success now. And you can read about this story and even more in your new book, Fantasy Life, which you can get at fantasylifethebook.com. But this is an amazing story and good to get some insight on what this is. So for our last question, high-low, one thing you're proud of, one thing you're embarrassed by.
One thing I'm proud of, it's a very small moment. It's a very small moment at the beginning of the movie. He gets in the limo and the driver hands him a headshot. you know, think somehow that they're important and hands him a headshot. And Paul Hogan takes out his wallet and hands him a picture of him and his kid, thinking this is what you do in L.A. You
I like that,
pictures.
Too.
I did like that joke, too, yeah.
I liked that, too.
So, yeah, I thought that was a small moment, and I thought that was very true to the character, and I thought that was kind of funny. So that's one thing that like that sort of survived as we wrote it. In terms of what we're embarrassed by, pretty much the rest of the movie.
I was hoping you'd say that.
Hey, we're pitching family comedy. That's what we are trying to do. We are literally saying, like, there's not going to be any, like, you know, pee-pee or poo-poo jokes. This is a movie you can take your 6-year-old to and not worry about. Something about Mary was the big thing. So we say, so we're saying this, and the whole thing is building towards a wedding. He's actually going to make an honest woman of Sue. That's the name of the character, of Linda's character, I think. And so... and so he says, what about something where, you know, he says, I think the teacher's probably got the hots for me or something like that, likes my, you know, charm. We're like, all right, fine. So we like, we do that. He tells us basically to write a woman hitting on him.
Sure.
So we're like, okay, fine. So we do that. And, we do that. And we'd actually said, well, like someone should hit on you, but let's do it at the gay bar. And you're not aware that he's hitting on you at all.
Really?
And you're
funny,
just
getting
he's along. He's like, no way.
Yeah.
Again, this is whatever. This is how long was the movie out? Like 15 years ago?
Sure.
I mean, this is what sounds old, like kind of old stale jokes now, was at least slightly fresh back then.
Yeah. 11 years ago, it was good. It was.
Right. So, anyway, so he's like, he didn't want to do that, but he wanted the teacher to hit on him. So we're like, fine. Find the teacher. So we write that. We write that scene, you know, and then we take long silkward showers after it. But whatever. We write the scene. And then the movie comes out, and we see it, and not only has the teacher hitting on him, but do you remember the rollerblader?
Yes,
yeah,
of
that's
course.
What we were just talking
oh, yeah.
about.
It's,
right, and we're just like, oh, good God, how many women are hitting on this 50-year-old dude?
She is not only hitting on him, but like she stops short, like rollerblading on Venice Beach Boulevard there to like throw herself at him and then have like a mini, like she has like a mini monologue to herself where she's like, I mean, what am I doing just talking to a cowboy on the side of the street? Yeah. I'm sure he's gay.
Yeah.
I'm sure
not my experience out here. It's cold, distant eyes.
Yeah.
Oh, this is too good. I finally bump into a cute cowboy. He's a little more Robert Redford's vintage than Brad Pitt's, but that's okay, because he's got a mansion in Beverly Hills, and plus he's got custody of his kid. That means he'd be a good dad to my Cindy. And this is... Oh, there's a cat tray. Nothing this good ever happens to me. I mean, you're not available. You're gay, right?
Most of the time, pretty happy. Yeah?
Of course! Cute cowboy, Venice Beach, happy to be gay. What was I thinking? Boy, she was a chatterbox.
Yeah, mate. An American woman.
She's got a nice ass.
Yeah.
If you want to ask me what's the most embarrassing scene, like for me, it's that.
Yeah, that's a good. That is a big one. Yeah.
Well, because it's so out of place in the movie. It makes no sense. No one talks like that. It's not real at all. It's not based in any sort of thing. It's entirely about his ego.
It's
that,
so
that scene
amazing.
Is entirely about his ego, which is sort of emblematic of the whole movie.
Well, Matthew, this is awesome to hear from your first-hand account about this movie. Thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, you were great. Thank you.
Yeah, you could check out his book, Fantasy Life. You can get it at fantasylifethebook.com. Matthew Berry, thanks so much for joining us.
Paul, fun as always. Thanks, guys.
Bye.
Bye.
Big thanks to Matthew Berry for actually telling us how Crocodile Dundee in Los Angeles got made. Unfortunately, Eddie Pepitone and June had to leave. So, Jason, it's you and I right now. Here we go. So, obviously, we had an opinion about this movie, but there are some people who had a different opinion. So, it's now time for Second Opinions. These are 5-star reviews culled from Amazon.
I feel like Second Opinions needs its own theme show music.
We used to have
horns. Second Opinions.
I like that. Somebody make that into a track and we will play that every single time.
Until we hate it. which will be 3 episodes from now.
But it will be a glorious 3 episodes. All right, this was actually a great treasure trove of Amazon reviews here. This is from GoBirds2, who, if you look in the 5-star reviews at Amazon, posted the same review at least 5 times.
With the nouns changed to other places, or always for this movie?
Always for this movie. Same review for this movie.
Got it.
So here it goes. You might say that Paul Hogan has his own brand of sophisticated humor. Sophisticated may sound like an odd word to describe his Outback brand of slapstick, but it really is. Crocodile Dundee is a slick character that you don't know that you're really being put on or not. I think we're all getting tired of the fast-paced, slam-bang, rapid-fire, so-called sophisticated humor. This film is a welcome return to good old-fashioned, homespun, grassroots comedy. There's so many things to unpack in this. Sophisticated is not a word that you want to...
Nope.
No, not at all. And I guess they're hypothesizing that this is like a Borat kind of character. Is he or is he not this character? Not that either. It's not Borat style. And we are all getting tired of that fast-paced, rapid-fire comedy.
Aren't we all? I'm so tired of laughs coming quickly at me.
Slow it down.
Slow it down.
Like
one laugh per every 15 minutes. Like, that's the thing in this movie... Like, they're in Los Angeles, California, and they walk everywhere. They're walking the equivalent of 25 miles a day.
It's crazy. And again, like I said, they never get too far away from Hollywood Boulevard.
No, never.
They're just walking in a constant circle. The only thing that was interesting to me, and this is, again, a sign of a bad movie, when you're watching a city that you live in, you go, oh, that's interesting. That's what that looked like back then. That's what that looked
like. But it is old-timey. There is an old-timey element to, like, him picking his kid up from school and then them walking home like Andy Griffith style.
Yeah.
You know? I get what that person is saying, even though that person is a fucking idiot.
Well, listen to what Liz has to say. Liz says...
Oh, Liz, don't get me started with fucking Liz
dude. Loves it. She goes, this is a great movie. I like the first one, but this is much better. It is very funny. I'm a comedy freak, I love funny movies. And this is definitely funny.
Oh, God.
The DVD is better. So rent it today because I'm sure you'll come back and buy it.
The DVD is better?
5 stars. I don't know how the DVD is. I guess
maybe
the DVD
the extras.
Is maybe just going, the process of going to the theater is a pain. So maybe...
Maybe it's just the extra features were like unstoppable on this.
Well, this is the one that I think... Okay, I don't know which one. This one is a genuine note here. The writing on Dundee, L.A. was excellent, with some very funny material. One minor flaw, in light of its family movie class, would be to change the unwed status of the couple to some sort of aboriginal outback type of hookup, maybe with flashbacks to some kind of ceremony before the child was born, and use that as the film's beginning marriage status. And then they could have ended it with a traditional Western marriage. That way they wouldn't look like the standard Hollywood shack-up type of situation, so common in liberal Hollywood scripts.
Yeah.
Wait a second. 5 stars. Obviously five stars.
Obviously 5 stars.
But
so, like, even with that, this person's, like, love for the movie was undeterred.
Yes. I mean, because, I mean, the liberal nature of this film, I mean, that's the thing I don't get. Like, the couple getting married at the end, that's a liberal agenda? That seems like...
No, the liberal agenda is that it's okay to have a child out of wedlock. The agenda is, you know, the being married to have a family isn't important until the end of the movie. He wants is for them to have some sort of marriage, even if it's like a aboriginal. What this fucking asshole is saying is, like, give them a pretend wedding like the pretend people in the Outback, which is, by the way, a real wedding, you fucking asshole.
You dummy.
And then give them a real wedding at the end. Like, what is wrong with people? Come
Five
on.
Stars.
Five
and
stars.
And here is my favorite one here, the final one. One thing that makes this such a great comedy is it doesn't have the feel of trying to be funny.
It's not burdened by that need to be funny.
There are some movies where the humor doesn't seem that funny to me, which is kind of embarrassing.
Oh boy.
What? but in this, every single joke got a laugh out of me. There's even an inside joke where she goes, which I understand, and I don't even live in LA, where the news broadcaster says 1/4 of an inch of rain was a downpour. Because the rainfall is so infrequent. Plus, the comedy is never sleazy or degrading.
Such an inside joke.
I know, it's such an inside. And he goes, I've seen quite a lot of movies, and I would put this among my top 5 comedies.
Wow.
Next two.
Here
are you ready
go.
For these?
Here we go.
All right. This is the best part of the whole review.
Top 5 comedies for who? Who is this person?
Her name is a customer.
Okay.
the Disney movie Blackbeard's Ghost.
Yep.
Jean Arthur's The Devil and Mrs. Jones.
Of course.
Danny Kaye's The Court Jester.
Oh, boy.
And Dick Van Dyke's Never Dull Moment.
Okay, this person is easily in his or her mid-70s.
But Crocodile Dundee 3 gets put into that pantheon.
That's crazy. My favorites, Paul Hogan, Danny Kaye, Dick Van Dyke,
and the Disney movie Blackbeard's Ghost. Oh, my God. So that's some
fun. And I like Ron Jeremy's pornographies.
So those are the 5-star reviews from Amazon. We'll close it up. As you can may or may not realize, our guests, everyone had to leave one by one. So it's just Jason and I in here. But I do want to tell you that Eddie Pepitone is a hilarious, funny stand-up. And this documentary that he did about himself is awesome. You go to thebitterbuddha.com. You can get the documentary. It's on iTunes. For anyone interested in the world of alternative comedy, it is a must. I say this not only as a fan of Eddie, but this is a true statement. This documentary is very good. You can follow him on Twitter at Eddie Pepitone and go to eddiepepitone.com. For me, you can check out the Arshirio Paul show. We have 7 new episodes up. You can check those out. Just type in Arshirio Paul.
It's spelled just like it sounds. Arshirio Paul.
Just like it sounds. Arshirio Paul. And you can also watch NTSF SD SUV every Thursday night. And one final plug is that June is in that as well. And Hell Baby is on VOD right now, which is on iTunes. I hope you guys like that. Jason, what, you want to plug anything?
I wrote on Children's Hospital this season, so watch that.
Very funny, Children's
Very
Hospital.
Very funny show. And then, I don't know. Yeah. You can always follow me at Twitter at, just kidding. I'm not on Twitter.
You were on Twitter, though,
for 30 minutes last week. I was on Twitter.
So people can look up Zooks 230.
That's what it was, yeah.
And they can follow your tweets. They will never come back. But
that account was immediately deleted.
Oh, was it? Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
I don't know if you can find. Can you find old tweets? Is that a thing?
You probably can find it somewhere.
Yeah. It's very boring what I was doing. But I was on Twitter for 30 minutes for John Daly's 230 show, whatever that's called.
How did you like it?
You know what? It was for half an hour, and a large portion of that was me trying to figure it out. You know, like a lot of it was me asking questions like, now how do I do this? But it was like within 20 minutes, I had over 400 followers.
Wow.
Which was so not, hilarious.
That is pretty impressive, and you just got rid of them instantly.
Yeah, then I rejected them.
So you can try to find that. You can actually watch Jason doing that live. The 230 PST podcast is actually a video podcast. It's on the Video Podcast Network. So you can see Jason on Twitter. For all of you asking, you can see him on Twitter, even though it doesn't exist anymore. And again, Fantasy Life by Matthew Berry. You can go get that. And a big thanks to everyone that helps run this show. Our engineer, Brett, thank you so much for doing this. And this is a complicated one today. Our researcher, Nathan Kiley, and of course, our new clip puller, Avril Halley. I had trouble with her name last week. I'm getting it now. We did it all. Thank you guys for listening. And the conversation doesn't end here. Go to our Facebook page, check us out on the Earwolf Forum, and more importantly, and very excitingly, we have a brand new Twitter page. That's right. We are HDTGM at HDTGM. That's our Twitter page. And you can hit us up there for comments, whatever you want to do. Check that out. And I will leave you with the sentiment that Croc 3 left us. The last line of the movie as Paul Hogan turns to camera. Enjoy. See you next time.
I think my crocodile hunting days are over. Yeah, from here on in, it's Mick Dundee, Private Eye. Nah, kidding.
This has been an Earwolf Media production. Executive producers Jeff Ulrich and Scott Aukerman. For more information, visit earwolf.com.
Earwolf Radio Boom.com.
The wolf dead.
Hey, everyone, it's Jessica St. Clair.
And Lennon Parham.
Hey, assholes, it's me, John Gabris.
Lauren Lapkus here.
We just wanted to talk about one of our favorite podcasts to be on and to listen to, Improv for Humans.
I'm a huge Improv for Humans fan. I've done a number of episodes myself. A couple great memories. One of them was when I got to argue about whether bestiality was disgusting or not.
A lot of times it's you, me, and Mandzukas,
yeah,
and Besser, and it's really old school, and there's something about not being on stage in front of an audience that makes you even crazier, yes, than you would be.
If I could recommend an episode to check out or a favorite memory from the podcast, I would say listen to some of the 420 episodes, because those are the ones I like to re-listen to, because I truly don't remember what I said.
Another great episode I loved doing was the Dan Deacon episode. I love his music, and being able to sit like 1 foot away from him and watch him create amazing music was so cool.
That's what's cool, is he gets people on for suggestions, yeah, often singers, songwriters.
Really,
if you're a real fan of improv, even if you've never actually heard improv before, this is a great introduction. You can't get better improv comedians than who he has on his podcast.
Everyone needs to be listening to Improv for Humans. Come on!
New episodes every Thursday. Be sure to listen to wherever you get your podcasts. But I recommend Stitcher. They make me say that.